Hello, and welcome back to Hanging Out with the Dream King, a Neil Gaiman podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Helt. In this episode, we'll be discussing the short story, The Problem of Susan, by Neil Gaiman. It first appeared in the anthology Flights, Extreme Visions of Fantasy in 2004. It was reprinted the same year in Neil Gaiman's Fragile Things. It also appears in Neil Gaiman's Reader. And there was a version that was adapted into comic form with the assistance of P. Craig Russell on art. And a couple other works exist in the same book, but it's The Problem of Susan and Other Stories, which Dark Horse released in 2019, I believe.
And as we said last time, we are doing this extra episode because we received a commission from one of our really generous Patreon supporters. Before we do anything else in this episode, we want to make sure that we say thank you so much for that. Episode commissions are a huge help in keeping us on the air. And also, it's been really fun, and I think really interesting as well, to revisit Narnia. Now, of course, we already did an episode on the Chronicles of Narnia here on this show. We have one more to come after this. That is an episode that I'm going to do on Atoz with my co-host Jay Deal. That'll be out in just a few days, so you know, you can check that out if you're not already subscribed to that show. Yeah, why not? Go ahead and do that. But all right, let's talk about what we're going to do in this episode. I will offer up a synopsis of the story, you know, as briefly as I can, rather than do a recap and commentary format, because we really want to get straight into the discussion about what is going on with this story. I mean, we have questions about the plot and about the world, but especially I think we want to talk about the themes in The Problem of Susan, which means that we are going to talk a lot about gender in the Chronicles of Narnia, and we're going to do our best with that. But since this is, at least I think anyway, Brent, I think, you know, generally regarded as a pretty important story in the Neil Gaiman canon of short stories, at least, I thought we'd probably just start with our own histories with The Problem of Susan. And you know, I just want to know, Brent, have you read this story before?
Yeah, I read this story when I first picked up Fragile Things when it came out in 04. It had been a long time between my reading the story and when I, prior to that, had last picked up any of the Chronicles of Narnia. Many years and many, many, many books had passed between those things. So I don't think it affected me quite as much as it did upon subsequent rereadings, particularly with us recently going through all the Chronicles of Narnia and then reading it again. We'll get into it as we go, but I remember the story I found technically good, but the first reading I found it irritating in a number of ways, which according to Neil's introduction, which we'll talk about, I think were all intentional. I think that the story probably hit me mostly as it was intended to hit you. But what was your first kind of encounter with this? Did you read this back in 04 when it came out, or did you hold off for a little while before reading it?
I did read this right when it came out. You've said 04, but I actually think Fragile Things came out in 06, and that matters only in the sense that I bought the hardcover copy of it when it, you know, I was like waiting in line to get it at the Barnes & Noble on Colorado Boulevard in Denver, which had attached to it a 24-hour Starbucks. This is when Brandon and I were working the same job together, and was a job that we did, you know, it was a job done round the clock, so we frequently were working night shifts, and this was the night before I needed to go back to work. It was a day off, but it was the you'd better stay up all night so that you can do it at work tomorrow. And so, yeah, I grabbed this book, grabbed a cup of coffee, and, you know, about 11:30 p.m. sitting outside, a beautiful autumn evening in Colorado, drinking a cup of coffee, reading about half of this collection. But I, like you, it had been a long time since I had read Narnia. And so it didn't, you know, the story, The Problem of Susan, didn't hit me in an emotional way. In fact, my takeaway from it was, maybe I should read Narnia again. It's been a long time since I've done that. And in fact, I remember talking with the people at work that weekend about Narnia and intending to go read it again and then never did until we've done it now for this show. But so that's been really exciting because it's, you know, been on my to-do list ever since Fragile Things came out. So, okay, great. Yeah, you and I read it, I think, basically exactly the same time, possibly exactly the same minute, but 2,000 miles away from each other, or maybe even 2,500 miles away from each other, and have never talked about this story except for building up to doing this episode, which is not the case for a lot of the short stories that we've covered on the show, where, you know, you and I read them together as teenagers. We have talked about them through the years, but here, this will be our first time going through this. And I think, you know, that'll be part of the fun here, because this is something of a contentious story in several different ways, as we'll get into. But that's putting the cart ahead of the horse. So let me get into the synopsis here for people who haven't read the story or haven't read it in a while. All right, so this story is chiefly about Professor Hastings, who is a scholar of children's literature. She is old now, she's recently retired, and the story is mostly from her perspective, though there is also another point of view character. This is Greta Campion, who is a reporter, and she is writing an article about Professor Hastings, and I'm going to come back to her in just a moment. The story unfolds through each point of view, really through their conversation together, but also through two dream sequences. Maybe we should say three. We'll take that up later. What we learn is that this is our world, and the Chronicles of Narnia and C.S. Lewis exist in this world. What we also learn is that Professor Hastings's biography shares a lot of details, a lot of overlap with the biography of Susan Pevensey from The Chronicles of Narnia, which is to say that her sister, her two brothers, and her parents all died in a car crash when she was in her late teens, and that this was the 1950s. And at least one of those siblings shares a name with one of the Narnia characters, and that's Ed. And we also learn some details of the professor's sex life when she was younger. Normally, this is the sort of thing that I would not mention on the air and frankly would just headcanon out of a story, but it is likely to be important for our discussion. So I will say that the professor doesn't seem to have ever married, but she has had multiple sexual partners, and at least one of them was at least a little bit married himself at the time. Now, the interview ends up mostly being about the character of Susan, and especially about what is called here the problem of Susan. And that problem is that Susan was the one Pevensey sibling who was not allowed to return to Narnia in the last battle, or at least who didn't return to Narnia in the last battle. And Greta describes the reason, and here I'm just going to quote the text. "She's no longer a friend of Narnia because she's too fond of lipsticks and nylons and invitations to parties." And as we'll see in a little bit, that is something of a paraphrase of what's in the text of Lewis's book. At any rate, Professor Hastings does not really want to talk about this, and she seems to take this all personally. That's something we're also going to return to in just a moment. Because the last thing that I need to include in this synopsis is that there are two italicized dream sequences. They both occur in Narnia during the events of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Both are from the perspective of Susan, though it is not necessarily the case that Susan is actually the dreamer here. In the first of these sections, the battle between Aslan's forces and the witch's forces has just ended, and the dreamer is taking stock of the dead on the battlefield. She pays particular attention to a centaur's genitals and imagines what it would be like to have sex with a centaur, and sex features in the second dream as well. And in this case, though, we know that the dreamer is Greta. And in this dream, Aslan and the witch have come to an agreement, just like they do in the book. But in this case, the agreement is actually about divvying up the Pevensey kids to eat. Aslan eats Greta, who is appearing as Susan in this dream, but Greta also has to watch Aslan and the witch have sex before she herself is fully consumed. And that is most of the story. I've left out some bits that I think we will get to in the discussion, and of course, I have told it all out of sequence and in my paraphrase rather than Neil Gaiman's beautiful prose, so, you know, take it for what it is. But all right, let's do what we're here to do, Brent, and get into the discussion. We need to... I think probably the first thing we need to do is to establish a foundation about what is happening in the story before we take up the problem of Susan. And The elephant in the room, of course, is the question of whether or not Professor Hastings is actually Susan Pevensey in some way. And if so, what precisely that way is? What do you think?
I think that Professor Hastings is Susan. I think that this is an instance that we see frequently deployed very well by Neil Gaiman, where he takes a fictional character and he says, what is it like if this fictional character actually existed in our world or the world, right? And so I think that's what we have here. I think Susan is Susan Hastings. Professor Hastings is Susan Pevensey, grown up, different last name. So maybe at some point she was married, not clear.
Yeah, I think so as well, though I might be less sure of this answer than you are, or at least than you seem to be. I have gone back and forth on this. Certainly my first reading of this story was that she was Susan. And I mean that, you know, back 20 years ago, enjoying a nice cup of coffee on an autumn evening in Colorado. But I also mean the first time I read the story for when we're getting ready to do this episode as well. But going back through it, you know, the second and third of the, I don't know, 10 times I read the story for doing this episode, I had a little more hesitation about that. But I do think that I'm back on board with, yeah, this character, Professor Hastings, is Susan Pevensey. But more to the point, everybody knows that. That this seems to be a world in which, yes, the Chronicles of Narnia were stories, or, you know, a series of kids' books written by C.S. Lewis. And, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of people have read them and cherished these books. And also, everyone knows that Professor Hastings is Susan, and that, like, this family actually existed, and that these stories are true in some way, right? I mean, that's my sense of this, that these stories are true in some way. Do you agree?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I also sometimes have gone back and forth a little bit on whether this is Susan. I think the story can work equally well even if this is not Susan, if there's just a lot of things that Professor Hastings has in common with Susan Pevensey, at least until a certain age, might very well be true. I've actually come to the opposite side from where you've landed as to whether people are aware of this. So for me, this is Susan, but I think that at times I've read it that Greta is aware of it. I think Greta is not necessarily aware that this is Susan Pevensey, but we can get into that a little bit. But I think that the Chronicles of Narnia in this context, if this is Susan, if we live in a world where C.S. Lewis exists writing the literature, it's one of those things where it is the author recounting, probably with some liberal authorial ability there to, you know, based on a true story, what is going on, how he would know all of the details, who knows. Some of them might be made up entirely. Some might be things that he heard at some point from teenagers telling him about coming back from, you know, going on trips to Narnia. But that, to me, is kind of the mental construct of it. It's that the Chronicles of Narnia are a based on a true story kind of collection, but I don't know that everyone knows that they are necessarily based on a true story.
To elucidate things for our listeners here, I think the line or the moment in the story that, you know, that we're using here to think about whether or not Greta and by extension other people are aware that Professor Hastings is Susan Pevensey, or the inspiration for Susan Pevensey at least, and in some way, is that Greta is, during their interview, you know, Greta is the one interviewing Professor Hastings, and Greta, you know, wanders into wanting to talk about the problem of Susan, which is to say her reading of the Chronicles of Narnia, but we're inside her perspective in that part of the story. And so we have her thinking that she should probably abandon this line of questioning because she knows that it's very personal for Professor Hastings, but she kind of can't stop herself from wanting to say this. I think we have all had this kind of conversation with someone before, almost always happening when we're a little bit Star Trek, or almost always happening when we're a little bit starstruck in some way. And that's what's happening here. And so, yeah, it may be the case that the reason that Greta wishes that she would stop talking about this is that she knows that this is actually the character from the book in some way, or it may simply be that she's aware that Professor Hastings also lost her family in a similar type of accident, and that, you know, perhaps that's not the thing that you should be bringing up in an interview that's really meant to be about Professor Hastings' work rather than about her biography. But because we are in Greta's point of view, all we're getting there are her feelings about this rather than all of this spelled out the way I have just spelled it out. So it's not clear which of these is going on or if both of them are going on. And so it is completely up to interpretation. And of course, I think as always, we would love to hear what listeners think about how to answer this question. I want to return briefly before we move on to talking about dreams, Brent. I do want to return briefly to this question about the trueness of the Narnia stories and Lewis's involvement in them. And it is difficult for me to conceive of how the Chronicles of Narnia, as Lewis wrote them, could be objectively true, because there's so much happening, especially in the last battle, that Lewis simply wouldn't be able to know. You made a joke here, Brent, about how perhaps what he's writing down are these accounts that he actually gets from these kids who are visiting Narnia when they come back. And that certainly could be true for almost all of the books. But I think that there are particular places where that would break down. One of them has to be the last battle, where we get the rest of the Narnian, you know, human characters from Earth who cross over to Narnia, mostly the Pevensies and friends, perhaps we should call them, going into heaven, going further up and further in. They don't come back from that, right, to give that account to Lewis. So how would Lewis know that? How would he be able to write that down? And then I think we also might need to ask some questions about how exactly Lewis has access to the story in The Horse and His Boy as well, at least to tell it from the perspective that he tells it, that he certainly would be telling a story that's at least secondhand there. So yeah, anyway, there are problems with how we might think about that. And again, this is something I think within the world of The Problem of Susan that is definitely open for interpretation. It excites me a lot to have, to have this be vague in the story. For me, I think this is part of what makes this a real masterpiece. Well, you've brought up dreams, and I think that that is where we need to go next. And I think we will want to return back or circle back to this question of maybe C.S. Lewis, you know, in the world of the story, that C.S. Lewis is actually learning about some of these things in dreams. Dreams are super important in the story. It opens with a dream sequence. It closes with a dream sequence. There's actually another dream sequence in the middle that I haven't brought up yet, but we're going to do it shortly. We're going to do that in this section of the episode here. But the first thing that I want to just clarify where we stand on this before we move on to talking about dreams more broadly is the identity of the dreamer in the first italicized dream. Is that Greta as well? Is it Greta's dream that bookends the story, or is that some other person who's dreaming that starts the story?
I think part of the context for this whole story reiterates an idea that Neil goes to frequently about the importance and power of stories. In fact, it specifically is discussed when they talk about children's literature. They talk about Professor Hastings, who may or may not be Susan, definitely is familiar with the Narnia books. Greta, very familiar with them, knows them quite well, lights up and pays far more attention to the conversation when she can talk about it, to the point of ignoring the fact that she is talking to someone who is still years later, probably mourning the loss of all of their family. And so for me, the initial dream, I think, is Greta's dream, but it's also Professor Hastings' dream. I think the first dream is actually emblematic of kind of the shared narrative experience that we have. So equally, in some ways, the first dream might have been your or my dream if our thoughts at a certain age would be about the male genitals of a centaur. It might be that at some point we had a dream in which we were also thinking about the genitals of something in Narnia.
Okay, that's a really interesting answer. That was not on my menu of possible answers to that question. So I guess I'll have to give that some more thought. I certainly read this, you know, the first time, both 20 years ago and then jumping in for this episode, just assume that this was Susan, because we don't get the revelation that Greta is having dreams about Narnia from this vivid perspective of Susan, of being Susan in the dreams. We don't get that until the end, right? So you're almost all the way through the story before you get that. And then you'd need to go read it again with that information in mind. And so I guess I came down on the side of that is Greta's dream, that Greta is dreaming about Narnia as if she is Susan in this particularly vivid way that is also wrapped up in sex and sexuality and in some way that we certainly will get into in a little bit. I don't quite know what to make of that. So I'm going to put a pin in that because I want to walk through a little bit more about how dreams are functioning in this story or where we see dreams in this story, perhaps. And then we can maybe zoom back out and talk about dreams writ large in the story, because in the middle of the story, Professor Hastings is also having a dream. It's a dream in which she's in her own home. She's in a spare room that she has, a study. She's engaged in some kind of activity. I mean, what she's doing is actually looking at old photos of her family. This is after Greta has left, after the interview has reminded her of her family and these years. And then she gradually realizes that she's not in that real room in her house because there's furniture in this room that she doesn't have in the actual room in her house. And also the Narnia books are there. And those books, we are told, she does not keep in the house. And then also she realizes that she's dreaming because she encounters a Mary Poppins book called Mary Poppins Brings in the Dawn. But we are told that this is a book that P.L. Travers had never written while she was alive. And so it's hard to read this, Brent, without thinking that Professor Hastings is visiting Lucian's library right now, or at least has checked something out from Lucian's library. And given the vividness of these other dreams, and especially if we're thinking, as you are, Brent, that this is a kind of shared dream that Professor Hastings and Greta are having, is this a Sandman story that just doesn't have dream in it?
I think one of the great things about when Neil created Sandman and the characters within it is that they can kind of lay over almost anything. So I think certainly this can be a Sandman story. I think that Mary Poppins is death, right? We can talk about that a little bit, but there's a lot of things in which those characters are the same. So we have a Lucian's library story, but we also have that, well, Morpheus does not appear. His sister does. She just has an umbrella and can float up into the heavens. But I think a lot of this is because Neil is here, as he does in Sandman, playing with kind of the anthropomorphic personifications of ideas, which is similar to what directly C.S. Lewis does in terms of Aslan equals Christ, which he's more explicit about as the series goes, which we've talked about. But I think in this way, certainly this can very easily be a Sandman story, or the Sandman can very easily be otherwise under the same general kind of construct as this story falls under. That's what works for me. But did you, when you were thinking of this question, which you had, let me know you were going to ask in advance, were you specifically during one of your recent readings of the story thinking of Mary Poppins and the equation with death?
I was not. I was fortunately not actually drinking something when you said that. Otherwise, it would be all over my computer screen. But I think that's great. Let's walk listeners through this. I'll explain what this Mary Poppins book is, and then you can explain where you are seeing this Mary Poppins is death, at least in this book, by which I mean the book Mary Poppins Brings in the Dawn. The plot of this story, and I mean, this is cool because Professor Hastings actually gets to read this book in the dream. It's fantastic. So the plot of this book is that Jane and Michael, those are the kids from Mary Poppins, they follow Mary Poppins to heaven on her day off. And in heaven, Jesus is there, but he is still a little scared of Mary Poppins, who, it turns out, used to be his nanny. And Mary Poppins, a little bit scary. And God says that he didn't create Mary Poppins, and she is therefore out of his control. And God might also be a little bit scared of Mary Poppins, though the narrator doesn't tell us that explicitly the way that he does about Jesus. So that's what we get. Walk me through this. How does Mary Poppins stand in here as an analog for the character of death from Sandman?
Sure. First off, I want to remind everyone that one of the first things that we hear the character Death say when she first appears in the Sandman comic is to quit Mary Poppins. Now, specifically in this story, we know that by the end of the story, Professor Hastings has died. So the timeline in which Death would appear, if Death existed in the same world, to escort Professor Hastings to wherever she goes, should go next. And that is individual per person and not something that anyone else really necessarily can know, would be around the same time that she is having this dream. So my idea is, my construct in my head is that my headcanon, we'll call it my headcanon. That's probably a better way to refer to it. My headcanon is she is having a dream. She is in the dreaming. She dies there. I guess we know from Sandman comics, if you die in the dreaming, maybe you can stay in the dreaming if you want. But let's say that's not what's going on. Death then shows up to bring her to the next place. The next place is she wants to see all of her family who she misses and everything. She sees her own obit in the story, which she gets to see everyone again. And she essentially goes to Narnia, and she is not she's like, but wait, I was told I'm not supposed to be able to go to Narnia. And then, you know, the professor, or, you know, at this point, Jane, I believe, is the character, right? From Mary Poppins, says to God, but that's against the rules. And the God says, but she's Mary Poppins. I can't tell her what to do. And I think there's a lot of things going on there. The idea that if death is Mary Poppins in this equation, we have seen many other places where death actually kind of, and the endless kind of sit over kind of gods that are dependent upon faith and, you know, various views, you know, powered by worshipers and such in the context of Sandman. Also, like, we don't see death or any of the endless appear in American Gods, for instance, but notionally, if they did exist, they would be a couple rungs above all of the various personifications of different gods that Neil writes about in American Gods. And so my headcanon is that this is death, and that death wasn't created by this particular god, at least. This particular god can't tell death what to do. No one can tell death what to do or what not to do. She was born, you know, millisecond after destiny, and she will be the last one to close up when everything is said and done and move on. She will outlive everyone, and she's going to go wherever she wants. And her job is to escort people to where they should be going. And for Professor Hastings, it is to get to a place where she will see everyone again. Essentially, Professor Hastings is able to nullify any bar that somebody might say that Susan can't go to Narnia, the further up and further on. And nope, Susan gets to go there because Mary Poppins says she gets to go there. So that's the Mary Poppins death. I also have other Mary Poppins thoughts, but let me stop there so you can tell me any thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, and I have a lot of them. I'm glad that you emphasized here at the end this business about, you know, death's job being to be there when everything is closing up, and then to, you know, close the door and lock it, I guess. Because interestingly, we get, right, in the last battle, we actually get a world closing up exactly like that. I don't know that, you know, Gaiman is doing anything with that in this story, but it is interesting to think about, you know, really going back to our previous episode and thinking about ways in which Gaiman has been influenced by C.S. Lewis, that the idea of closing up a world like that, I mean, I wonder if that is really the image that Gaiman has in his mind, whether he's aware of it or not, you know, when he's thinking about this is what death's job will be, is this really protracted scene where Aslan is doing exactly that same thing. I did not make that connection before, but I think it's actually a pretty strong one. So that's awesome. The other thing I want to say, Brent, is that you have done something that I'm very grateful for, which is that you have demonstrated clearly that covering Mary Poppins is well within the purview of this show. So listeners can look forward to that perhaps after our next round of Sandman, which I will be very, very excited to cover, because it turns out my wife, Elizabeth, has never, ever seen Mary Poppins, which I just find mind-boggling, but is obviously something that has to be rectified. And this will give me an excuse, a reason to rectify that quickly.
Well, and in talking with my partner last night, another Elizabeth, she's read some Mary Poppins. I've never read any Mary Poppins. I've only seen the original film. And so an excuse to probably actually pull out and read some P.L. Travers for the first time in my life is probably an excuse I would welcome.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I have read only the very first Mary Poppins book and only read it one time. And I read it while I was living in Oxford, and I read it entirely in a pub that C.S. Lewis used to go to. So feels like something's trying to tell me someone, I guess, is what's happening here. So anyway, yeah, we've wandered into that. But you said you had more thoughts about Mary Poppins. So let me just get out of your way here for those.
Another thing that is going on here with Mary Poppins is Mary Poppins is oftentimes viewed as kind of a divine, kind of either angelic or even actual like deity. After the story is published years later, Alan Moore will include a character that essentially is Mary Poppins in his League of Extraordinary Gentlemen series, in which Mary Poppins is God and is there to defeat the Antichrist. So Mary Poppins as a divine figure is kind of very much kind of an established thing, at least in some context. Also, Mary Poppins, created by P.L. Travers. P.L. Travers, a woman. C.S. Lewis, a man who writes Aslan, who seems to occasionally have some limited views, questionable handling of female characters. And so I kind of see it as he's very much writing things from, and you know, it's not that his books aren't appropriate for, young girls particularly to read, but they're definitely, and we can get into this, but there definitely are some problems in which how he, has created and how he has dealt with many of the female characters that he did create, versus the male characters. So I kind of see Mary Poppins as in some ways the equal to Aslan as the kind of male versus the feminine of kind of the divine. And so in that way, Mary Poppins also doesn't have to follow the rules that a C.S. Lewis god would give, because that's kind of the male god. The male god doesn't get to say how things are. This whole story is about women, not just Mary Poppins, but Professor Hastings and Greta. And that's part of why it ties me to the idea that that first dream is kind of a shared dream, in which there might be kind of variations that they're each are having in terms of it. They might see different faces of different people they might know. They might be thinking about slightly different ways the genitalia may or may not look. But in my mind, that is, at least that first dream is a shared dream. And it's all about the shared experience of how feminine readers are receiving kind of stories as children and how that kind of lodges in their subconscious and then can play out in dreams and also the way kind of their stories spin out. So it's kind of the feminine half versus the masculine half is kind of what I see going on there. But a lot of that's because of the larger context of things that we've only hinted at, but now I think we're going to discuss a little bit more, which is how we deal with some gender issues in the Narnia books.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about here. I want to start with just narrowly focusing in on the problem of Susan as it's presented in the story by Neil Gaiman here. Before we do that, though, I just want to say, Brent, that you have opened up a huge can of Mary Poppins here, where like I'm now seeing an entire series of episodes that deal with Mary Poppins. Like, I don't know, there might be like a dozen episodes we could do there. I guess if listeners are interested in that, let us know. We'll see if we can do that. It'd be a great reason to go read some more Alan Moore again. For sure. All right. Yeah. Let's talk about the problem of Susan here, which is to say, why is she excluded from Narnia? I do just want to talk about this to start from the perspective of what's happening in the story. What is Gaiman's interpretation here? But this is obviously exactly that. It is an interpretation of what is actually happening in C.S. Lewis's text. So I'm going to start with really the two passages that I think matter here from Lewis, and then let's talk about how Gaiman is interpreting those passages. The first of them comes from Prince Caspian. It's a bit of dialogue that we get from Peter. I'm just going to do this as if it's a script here without the dialogue tags, but here's what Peter says near the end of Prince Caspian. And the person that Peter is referring to here with just the pronoun he is Aslan. So at least this is what Peter says. At least from what he said, I'm pretty sure he means you to get back someday, but not Sue and me. He says we're getting too old. It's all rather different from what I thought. You'll understand when it comes to your last time. So, okay, this is the first instance in which we're, get anything about Susan not being able to go back to Narnia. Also includes Peter there. And then the more extended passage, and it's really the one that I think matters most for the story. It is paraphrased, alluded to here in the story. This is from near the end of the last battle. This is actually a much bigger conversation. Again, I'm going to just treat this like it's a script rather than including all of the dialogue tags and descriptors and so on. So here's what Peter says. "My sister Susan is no longer a friend of Narnia." And then Eustace jumps in. He says, "Yes, and whenever you've tried to get her to come and talk about Narnia, she says, 'What wonderful memories you have. Fancy you're still thinking about all those funny games we used to play when we were children.' And now Jill has something to say about this. She says, 'Oh, Susan, she's interested in nothing nowadays except nylons and lipstick and invitations. She always was a jolly sight too keen on being grown up.' And then finally, Polly, who's described here or characterized here as Lady Polly, says, 'Grown up indeed. I wish she would grow up. She wasted all her school time wanting to be the age she is now, and she'll waste all the rest of her life trying to stay that age. Her whole idea is to race on to the silliest time of one's life as quick as she can, and then stop there as long as she can.'" So those are the passages that we get in Narnia about Susan being excluded from Narnia. And so, yeah, the question here is, how does Gaiman interpret this in The Problem of Susan? What is Gaiman's understanding of these passages? Why is it that Gaiman thinks Susan doesn't go back to Narnia in the last battle?
And we're going to have to do a little bit of interpretation here because he's not 100% direct on it. But based on this particular story, it seems to be that the idea of Susan growing up and focusing on things that young women focus on, particularly the idea of the nylons and lipstick and invitations, he's very much interpreting in kind of a interest in not just, but kind of sexual understanding, maturation, and those kinds of things seems to very much be at play. And I think it interlaces into the dreams that we see someone is having in regarding Susan, her experience, the dream we've talked about, as well as the dream that will come. That seems to be very much the focus of things, is that the idea of nylons and lipstick being signifiers of, you know, wanting to appear sexually attractive to prospective partners. And then there's specific discussion that he has where Professor Hastings is remembering like losing her virginity and relationships she's had in the past. And it's not done with any kind of prudish moralizing the way that you would have been presented if this character was in a C.S. Lewis book. But that's kind of my interpretation of what Neil is seeing as the reason here. I think there's a couple other interpretations as to what C.S. Lewis might have meant, but I think that's where Neil has landed, at least for this story. Is that your interpretation as well?
It is, yeah. It has to do with growing up, and it has to do with female sexuality. That's what Gaiman is getting at here in the story. But like you, I want to point out that there are other interpretations of this. Also, we should point out that Gaiman is not the only person who has this interpretation. We have talked about this story in terms of it being C.S. Lewis fan fiction, but it might also be Philip Pullman fan fiction. We can talk about that in a little bit. Because people who react against this view, that not usually reacting against Neil Gaiman, but against people who presented this view prior to this story, we'll go back to the bit of the text that I read and point out that what's happening here is that these characters who know Susan are talking about Susan in these terms. This is where we get the nylons and lipsticks and invitations. That's from Jill. But that the definitive like statement of why she's not here is what comes from Peter. And it's the first line that's uttered here, which is simply, "My sister Susan is no longer a friend of Narnia." And then we do get a bit of reporting from Eustace here that also seems to matter, right? Which is that she won't come and talk with them about Narnia, and that anytime they ask her to, she acts as if Narnia is an imaginary place. It's something they made up when they were kids, and she thinks that something is wrong with the rest of them for wanting to continue this game when Peter is presumably 24 or 25, and then Eustace and Jill, Edmund and Lucy, all a little bit younger than that, but definitely, you know, like 16 or so driving age in America, right? That she thinks that's a little weird, and that really is meant to be an analog for not believing anymore, right? For having lost belief in Christ, right? From a Christian perspective, and I think specifically a Protestant Christian perspective here, a faith alone kind of perspective here, though that's perhaps a road we don't want to go down too far in this episode. But at any rate, that's the theology here, is that it's that. That's the actual like metaphysical reason why she's not in Narnia at this point. But yeah, I was interested in reading this criticism. There's kind of a debate here, right, in Narnia criticism about exactly this. And there are these kind of two camps, and Gaiman in the story is occupying one of them. And maybe this is actually a good place to talk about some other places where this interpretation has been presented. You know, I mentioned Philip Pullman earlier. Philip Pullman, of course, has written his own kids' books, His Dark Materials, which, you know, is pretty good. I think that's been adapted for the screen in some ways as well, maybe multiple ways. But he wrote in an article that was published in The Guardian in 1998, the article is called The Dark Side of Narnia. This is, he really offers up this same kind of critique, although Pullman, I should say, was everywhere in media in the late 90s and the early 2000s saying this sort of thing. I heard him on the radio at least twice, and you know, two different NPR stations in America heard him saying exactly this sort of thing in an interview. And I think that perhaps is kind of most directly where Gaiman was thinking about this again, because there was no way to be a fantasy writer in the late 90s and the early 2000s and to not be engaged with Philip Pullman in some way, right? But also in the 90s, there was a book by John Goldthwait called The Natural History of Make-Believe. That's a really interesting book. People definitely should read that. It might be fun to do an episode about that book someday. But he has a real kind of, I don't know, takedown, I guess, of Lewis. Also of Tolkien and lots of other beloved classics. That's really kind of what this book is. And then there's also this biography of C.S. Lewis published in 1990 by A.N. Wilson. That's Andrew Norton Wilson, who's a novelist and journalist, really. Wrote a biography of Lewis from a particularly Freudian perspective. I've read this book. I mean, I hadn't read it before, but I read it for this episode. It's incredibly readable. I mean, like, you can see where he's a novelist. It's incredibly readable, but it is also bonkersly wrong about a lot of things, but it also is a bit of a takedown. And I think really got the ball rolling on taking down C.S. Lewis as a kind of industry that's cropped up since his book was published in 1990. So I think that's kind of the milieu that Gaiman is coming at this from.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple things in there that I kind of want to respond to. One, I think you're correct in pointing out in the Last Battle passage that Peter is the only one who gives us probably the definitive, as far as we can get it, information of the no longer a friend of Narnia, and we're left to figure out what that might mean. Eustace and Jill and Polly then kind of do a fair bit of gossiping, a number of commentators have pointed out that they are the people who probably know her far less than her own brother, Peter, and Edmund and Lucy. Like, the people who would know her most are not commenting further other than just Peter saying no longer a friend of Narnia. It's the people who probably don't know her that well, if at all, really. I mean, a cousin, so some interactions, and so aware that she doesn't want to talk to Narnia. But there's lots of times sometimes you don't want to talk to a younger cousin when you're probably a preteen or a teenager. And so it may not actually be the topic. One of the larger things that people get into when discussing this, particularly kind of apologists for the problem of Susan, to those who want to assuage that there is no problem here, is that later in life, C.S. Lewis, in writing, corresponding with fans, would say sometimes that he hoped one day, but he maybe wouldn't do it, and it'd be a much more of a grown-up novel to do so, would tell the story of how Susan maybe would be able to get back to Narnia. And a lot of people pointed out that this somewhat mirrors his own kind of life history, where he, for a period of time when he was kind of younger, did not consider himself a Christian, and then later in life found himself increasingly devout before his death. And so it could be that Susan actually here is the author insert for C.S. Lewis, and that perhaps he's trying to set that up. I think that interpretation may work somewhat. However, there's a lot of just kind of layering on how thick and dismissive that he is. And maybe he's beating himself up if this is the author insert as he goes here too, but it's just the level of unfairness, I think, is what Neil is regarding with how dealing with Susan. If it was just Peter's line and we left it there, or we even inserted a line of like, she's not a friend of Narnia, but maybe she will be sometime in the future, or maybe we'll see her in the, like, there's no, we don't get any glimmer. This is the last mention we get of her in the last battle. So we don't get any of that. And I think that Neil is directly responding to that when writing the story and talking about what the ramifications would have been for Susan if she was a real person, of losing all of her family in a train crash.
I want to take us back to Lewis just a second here and to say that his book, Surprised by Joy, is probably the second greatest conversion narrative in Christian apologetic writing, or the tradition of Christian conversion narratives. It's a really phenomenal book, even if perhaps, you know, leaves some things out of Lewis's life. It's a kind of autobiography. And I say second greatest because, right, Augustine's Confessions, of course, always going to be the greatest there. So, yeah, Lewis had this profound conversion moment when he was older than Susan is, but definitely seems to be thinking about his own time when he was in his early 20s, at a time when he was, avowedly an atheist, and also leading a life in which he had a kind of secret sex life that maybe he was a little ashamed of, and so on. And so I think there is a way to do this kind of Freudian reading of the text if you want to do that sort of thing. And as you say, lots of people do want to do that sort of thing. It is all over the defense of this. But I agree. I think, you know, if I'm reading this text, and reading text is a thing that I do professionally, and I'm trying to answer the question of why is Susan excluded from Narnia, it is simply that line from Peter that I'm going to go to say that's the answer. That's the noun. And everything else that everyone is saying is really an adjective modifying that noun, right? Just to put it in weird grammatical terms for some reason. But nonetheless, I think we can't, you know, we don't want to, though many people do, leave it there, because I don't want to shy away from the fact that Lewis does still then put all this other business in here about the nylons and lipstick and invitations. He does have characters in the book frame her not being a friend of Narnia in these terms that are about being a woman, that are about being grown up, and about being interested in sex. That whether or not those are the actual activities or interests that mean she can't come to Narnia or not, it's still adjacent to that. It's put into this package by Lewis in a way that makes me really uncomfortable, and clearly makes Gaiman uncomfortable. I mean, he says that explicitly right in the introduction to Fragile Things. So, you know, even if we couldn't infer that from the story, that we can, we have Gaiman explicitly saying that. It's made Philip Pullman uncomfortable. It's made many, many people uncomfortable. And I'm just going to say definitively on the record, that includes me. I am uncomfortable with the way that he writes this. And so I think this then has us, ask the question, and by us, I mean all readers, right, of whether C.S. Lewis is a misogynist, or, you know, doesn't like girls and women in some way. And I think you can find some evidence of that in Narnia. And I'm not saying that's the conclusion we're going to draw, but I think that what we ought to do is go through some of that evidence. And I guess, Brent, were there, you know, some places where, you know, you saw some of this in Narnia, or places just where Lewis was writing about girls and women, or even just writing about gender, that I guess just made you uncomfortable?
Certainly. And I mean, a lot of it is just, I mean, with all these things, we regard the author and the time in which they are writing. Some are even terrible for the time in which they write, even though we love their work, H.P. Lovecraft. Some, you know, we can more readily dismiss and not pass judgment on so much the author as just be aware of the limitations of their writing, particularly when male writers are writing female characters. The Silver Chair, which you and I discussed how much we like it as kind of our, you know, runner-up best book in the series. Besides Lucy, all of the women in this story are, we mention of a mother who dies off screen. And otherwise, we have kind of evil female characters throughout, in terms of every time we cross a woman, probably evil or aligned with evil. And we also have the instances, I mean, early on, even in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Susan is given a bow, but told specifically, like, don't use it unless you really have to. So we've got very easily the idea that, and of course, you know, it's typical kind of mores of 40s and 50s in terms of women in combat. And we've, I will use the word evolved since then to have a better understanding of the fact that we do not need to limit the role of women when it comes to you know, military duty, among other things. But I think particularly the Silver Chair is really what stands out, where we've got the evil, you know, the evil Emerald Queen underground, and we've got the evil Giant Queen and her maid, who is not as evil, but, you know, not evil. And again, besides Lucy, the only other woman who's mentioned who is not an evil woman in that is the mother who has died off screen, Caspian's queen. Also, we get that weird bit at the end where C.S. Lewis, after spending time revisiting how terrible the progressive institution of school is, where bullying is run amok, which bullying running amok is a bad problem. I don't know that progressivism is the only place where that can, you know, I think that that's a separate thing rather than the particular tact being taken by the leadership of the school. I think that's bad leadership, independent of whether you have a more traditional view of things, and you're breaking out rulers and nuns, versus if you've got, you know, bullies who are running and you're trying to do psychological experiments on children. Probably not good to do psychological experiments on children. But he goes out of his way to say that the headmaster is a woman, by the way, and then goes off briefly about how she eventually joins Parliament. Like, there's a lot he's got going on there that I'm sure the biographers can speak to this, that there's one or multiple specific members of Parliament he has a thing against, but that's a weird, unnecessary thing. It's not needed at all in the story, that once things have wrapped up and you've got the children coming back with their weapons to attack their classmates, again, weirdly problematic, particularly in the age that you and I unfortunately live in. But nonetheless, like, that can be the conclusion without Len, and the fact that the headmaster then is, you know, by authorities, no longer the headmaster, that's what we call a good ending. We don't need to say, by the way, the headmaster was a woman. It was a weird thing to say. So those are a couple instances that came to mind for me.
And you're really just scratching the surface there, and I'll bring up a few more. Maybe broadly speaking, something I want to point out is that one of Lewis's tricks, you know, gimmicks, narrative gimmicks here in these stories, is to pair up a boy and a girl of around the same age and then send them off to have an adventure together. That's loosely what's happening in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where we have Lucy and Edmund paired up in this way. And then it's more explicit in many of the other books, right, where we get Polly and Diggory, we get Aravis and Shasta as well, and also Jill and Eustace teamed up in this way. And while all of that teaming up is happening, this includes Lucy and Edmund, they are frequently bickering with each other and saying, you know, mean-spirited things to each other in terms of gender. And I don't know, I'll just give one example here. This is something from The Magician's Nephew. It's something Diggory says to Polly. He says, "Girls never want to know anything but gossip and rot about people getting engaged." And then Polly's response is to say that Diggory is exactly like a man. And there are, you know, just different variations on that theme all through the stories. This is something that Lewis, you know, is using as a kind of motif in some way. So that's one of the things that's happening there. Now, I don't think that everything that these characters are saying means that Lewis feels that way about any of these critiques. And in fact, I would point to this as one of the ways in which Lewis is writing about children in a more honest way than children's writers often do. You and I certainly grew up in a world in which boys and girls in grade school treated each other this way. You know, you and I grew up in a world in which the most insulting thing an eight-year-old boy could say to another eight-year-old boy is that you're being like a girl, right? And I'm not surprised to discover that perhaps C.S. Lewis grew up in a similar mindset, and hopefully we're done with that. I'm certainly trying to raise my own child in a way to suggest that we are done with that. But more to the point, something else that I want to bring up here is I was real interested in the way that Lewis is treating gender and particularly femininity in The Horse and His Boy. Aravis, I think, is a really interesting character. She was my favorite character when I was a kid. You know, if we'd had the conversation about which was our favorite Narnia book, you know, decades ago when we were, you know, 8, 9, 10, I would have said The Horse and His Boy. And the reason was I really liked the character of Aravis. But I was surprised on this reading to find how much C.S. Lewis puts in her mouth a lot of anti-femininity. And let me read a passage here and then talk about, you know, what I mean here. The fuss that Lasaraline made about choosing the dresses nearly drove Aravis mad. She remembered now that Lasaraline had always been like that, interested in clothes and parties and gossip. Aravis had always been more interested in bows and arrows and horses and dogs and swimming. Right, and this is not the first time we've heard something like this, right? That it is bad to be interested in material objects that are associated with femininity, right? This is really kind of how we got to this episode to begin with. And that it's good to be interested in boy things, even if you're a girl, but not good to be interested in girl things, even if you are a girl, right? Seems to be in the background of a lot of the way that Lewis is presenting boys and girls, and well, maybe just gender more broadly speaking, in his stories. And what I really want to point out here, though, is that Lewis is writing The Horse and His Boy. He's writing a story about a fantasy version, a fantastical made-up version of the Middle Ages, and that he's writing about a world in which women do not have agency, like social agency. They don't have legal agency. They don't have control over their own lives. He's writing about a fantasy world that's, you know, drawn on this historical analog in which women are not their own guardians, that they are without power in a legal sense. And that the way that women actually try to have any kind of control over their lives is to play the game of the system. And that means being interested in things like clothes and parties and gossip, that these might not actually be Lasaraline's real interests. She might also like to have hobbies that are about horses and dogs and swimming, that these aren't things that are hobbies for her. They might be, but that her primary interest in these things is that this is how she protects herself. This is how she keeps herself safe in a world in which she has no legal agency. And of course, since C.S. Lewis himself was a scholar, this is something that medievalists working on Western Europe, working on the Near East, the Mediterranean world, have written a lot about, looking at the way in which elite women like Lasaraline used the tools at their disposal to have a safe position, have a safe place in this world. And so this was a passage that really jumped out to me as, demonstrating one, Lewis's worldview, a worldview I think dictated very much by his own cultural context, but also reinforced to me where medieval studies is now versus where medieval studies was when Lewis was writing these books.
Even as C.S. Lewis is writing these stories in the late 40s and the early 50s, in Britain, women did not necessarily have the legal ability to initiate divorces, not universal acceptance that they could have bank accounts or lines of credit extended to them or own property, that even in his time, there were so many limitations put on what women were legally able to do, even more so than they had been during a medieval or, in his writing, faux medieval settings. Additionally, oftentimes in these restrictive places that women have found themselves historically, the ability to make choices regarding the application of makeup and within limits that you're able to make decisions about your clothing, that may be with a few elements of expression that those women have. And the ability to attend parties and accept invitations may be the few instances in which you are actually able to go unaccompanied to interact with friends and peers and colleagues without needing to be escorted by members of the family. Men historically have, throughout almost all societies, but particularly, in the areas in which he is writing in England, as well as kind of, Britain and Europe more broadly, but also kind of Arabian cultures, there's a lot more limitations put on where women are allowed to go by themselves, particularly in the medieval period. The idea that, she's excited about invitations because she gets to actually interact with her friends. She's not just cooped up waiting until she gets escorted somewhere. But again, also it's the ability to express herself. And in that way, Susan, being interested in lipstick and nylons, Susan gets to actually express herself and make decisions about herself and how she wants to present herself or aesthetic choices she is making regarding beauty. And there's a lot to be said about I think there's a lot of things you can say derisively about the fashion industry, such as it is. However, the idea of fashion as art is not something that should be belittled as much as I fear that C.S. Lewis probably regards it.
Well, I think we could go on like this for quite a while, Brent. And I mean, I know that we can because people have written entire books about exactly this topic. You and I have, you know, an hour or so that we want to do this as a kind of amateur internet radio. So I think maybe we'll start zooming back out a little bit here. You know, we're certainly not going to be exhaustive or comprehensive here. But I wanted to address one other bit here about gender in Narnia, and maybe specifically really the way in which women are often presented as evil. You brought up quite a bit of that. We could, you know, also point to the witch herself in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and make an even longer list than that. And this is something that other critics have held up to demonstrate that Lewis is a misogynist, and some of the critics that we've mentioned already. I should say, just to preface this, that, you know, this is about a 10-page short story. We then went collectively and read the 1,000 pages of the Chronicles of Narnia so that we could talk about this one 10-page story. I then, in addition to that, also just read thousands of pages of scholarship and criticism. It's been really dizzying, kind of whirlwind activity here that I'm really, really grateful to have had the chance to do. And so one of the things that I want to mention here is a book by Elizabeth Baird Hardy. Her book is Milton, Spencer, and the Chronicles of Narnia. She has, a few pages really where she addresses this issue head on, the idea of Lewis having all of these evil women in the Chronicles of Narnia and the question of whether or not that is indicative of some kind of misogyny. I don't know that Hardy really comes to a defense there, but one of the things that she does to nuance this view is to remind people that the Chronicles of Narnia are really some Milton and Spencer fan fiction, that Lewis is essentially a scholar of Spencer, loves Milton, wrote, in fact, an absolutely amazing work on Milton, really a preface to an edition of Paradise Lost that was going to be published. This preface is still today in print separately from any actual edition of Paradise Lost, right? So he's a Milton scholar. He's a Spencer scholar. He becomes that because he loves these works when he's a kid. And these works and other works that he read as a kid are all kind of getting jumbled together to make the Chronicles of Narnia in much the same way that everything Neil Gaiman read as a kid is jumbled together, right, to make his fantasy worlds and his fantasy stories as well. And so anyway, what Hardy points out here is that Lewis is lifting these characters entirely from Spencer and from Milton and then using them in similar ways, and that these then may not really be indicative of some worldview that Lewis holds. They may be, but they also may not be. It's not necessarily the case that they are so much as an indicator of what Lewis is doing in terms of writing fiction that is engaging with other fiction that he himself really loves. At any rate, I'll just sum that up by saying I thought this book was great. Elizabeth Baird Hardy, I recommend it to people to check out.
Despite criticisms we may have of some narrative choices that C.S. Lewis made, some limitations he might have unfortunately had imposed and even be blind spotted for him based on kind of his upbringing and his awareness based on the culture he was coming from. You know, we are, as is Neil Gaiman, a fan of C.S. Lewis. You can critique elements of a writer, and even you can critique the ability of a writer to write certain types of characters, in this case maybe not the best writer of women, without throwing out the works of the author here. And here I want to share something from the introductions in Fragile Things. I want to repeat, the Neil Gaiman Reader has this story along with 51 other works of Neil Gaiman. It is a great volume. Unfortunately, it lacks all of the intros that are in these smaller short story collections. If you have the Neil Gaiman Reader, I recommend going to a library and getting some of the other short story collections just to look at the introductions, because oftentimes he gives away what the impetus was for any given story or poem, and there's a lot of insight there. But I want to read an excerpt here from the introduction from Fragile Things. I read the Narnia books to myself hundreds of times as a boy, and then aloud as an adult, twice to my children. There is so much in the books that I love, but each time I found the disposal of Susan to be intensely problematic and deeply irritating. I suppose I wanted to write a story that would be equally problematic and just as much of an irritant, if from a different direction, and to talk about the remarkable power of children's literature. And I think that that nicely encapsulates, you know, a lot of the discussion that we've had then based on this oftentimes irritating short story he wrote. But that also it is in part our enjoyment of it and all of the things wrapped up in it and our enjoyment of revisiting Narnia is because of your and my love of the children's literature that helped kind of make us. So with that, maybe we should talk about favorite passages. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I will happily go first, but I'm going to comment on that introduction before I do that. Because, yeah, I just want to say that I share your assessment here as well, that I love C.S. Lewis and I love the Chronicles of Narnia, even if I do find these things uncomfortable, find them problematic. And I want to point out there that even, you know, Gaiman himself says every time, right, he finds this, but he continues to go back and read it and read it to his own children and to do that twice. And so, I think for me, I will just say, I also have read some of Narnia to my child. We didn't finish that. It was something we were doing when Finch was two, but as Finch gets a little bit older and gets interested in hearing that type of story again, I intend to read these books to him, even though I am uncomfortable with elements of it and perhaps even, you know, disturbed by some aspects of it. I still think this is great literature and I want to share it with my own child. So, okay, let's talk about the beautiful writing of Neil Gaiman here in this story. I'm going to read the opening bit of the story when we come out of the initial dream sequence. This is on page 182 of Fragile Things. There are things about herself that the professor despises. Her smell, for example. She smells like her grandmother smelled, like old women smell, and for this she cannot forgive herself. So on waking, she bathes in scented water and, naked and towel dried, dabs several drops of Chanel toilet water beneath her arms and on her neck. It is, she believes, her sole extravagance. Now, of course, one of the things I like about that is simply the, you know, the word smithing there, the cadence of the words, the sound of the words, that in itself is just brilliant. But I also like the way that this is Gaiman actually very subtly engaging exactly with the bit of text from the last battle that we read into the microphone here, where Polly says that Susan is in such a hurry to get to her early 20s, and then she's going to spend the rest of her life trying to stay there. We actually get a little glimpse of this character, Professor Hastings, Susan, right, doing exactly that here. But it's not called attention to by Gaiman at all. But it's a real indicator that Gaiman definitely has read the Chronicles of Narnia himself hundreds of times and to his children twice. He knows this text. He knows it really well. That was something I appreciated. But also, as we have talked about, you and I read this story ourselves, 20 years ago or so, just about 20 years ago, I guess, when we were, you know, perhaps around the age that Susan is in the last battle. We're now solidly middle-aged. And so this passage here, this opening with getting older and maybe not liking the things about yourself as you're getting older, not liking things about your body in particular as it is heading into its decline, is something that really resonated with me as solidly middle-aged. And, you know, less than a month away from my next birthday as well.
Yeah, it's a great passage. And that great, just the description of her morning routine, Professor Hastings does still focus a little bit, not in a sexual way, on lipsticks and nylons, but in terms of making conscious decisions about what she's going to wear. She also gets the mail. She clearly has mail. It might not be like my mail, which is mostly junk. There might actually be invitations in the mail, but she doesn't open it right away because she's not fixating on it, because it's not necessarily what she's fixating on. But it's a great passage. I had kind of a longer bit I wanted to read. It is, to me, though, the thing that really struck me and I think is kind of frames a lot of Neil's thoughts on the experience of this character. And I think when you're writing characters, it's good to think about, like, well, what is their experience of it? Not just, you know, what does the plot serve by having something occur? But this is in the conversation with Greta, in which Greta talks about what it must be like, to find out that what the fictional Susan must have thought is Greta's hypothesizing at the start of this. And then Professor Hastings is responding. I suppose Susan would have seen their bodies and thought they're on holidays now, the perfect school holidays, romping in meadows with talking animals, world without end. She might have done. I only remember thinking what a great deal of damage a train can do when it hits another train to the people who were traveling inside. I suppose you've never had to identify a body, dear. No. That's a blessing. I remember looking at them and thinking, what if I'm wrong? What if it's not him after all? My younger brother was decapitated, you know? A god who would punish me for liking nylons and parties by making me walk through that school dining room with the flies to identify Ed. Well, he's enjoying himself a bit too much, isn't he? Like a cat getting the last ounce of enjoyment out of a mouse. Or a gram of enjoyment. I suppose it must be these days. I don't know, really. And that just, it floored me when I first read it, and it always gives me pause every time I encountered it, kind of sense. There's a bit in the comic adaptation of this where you see it just kind of, there's not a lot of graphic detail, but there is like a fly on the panel, and it's very affecting. and I think that Neil thinking not just like, what is the problem of Susan, but must be actually Susan's experience of having to identify her family. And then there's also a bit later about, you know, financial challenges she might have experienced then too, because she was a young girl who, again, not a lot of economic opportunities for young girls in the 50s, but the ability to, you know, make what she can out of it. The fact that she was able to get the education to become a professor and write this book about children's literature, like, very much as a testament to the power of will that Susan, if Professor Hastings is Susan's, or even if she's not, if her nonetheless lost three of her siblings and her parents in a train wreck, that Professor Hastings must have had to get to the point where she's at. It's just, it makes her very much an inspiring character and well worthy of Mary Poppins' death escorting her to some kind of a promised land.
I know we're trying to wrap up here, Brent, and we definitely will do that. But your passage here has called to mind this letter that Lewis wrote in response to, you know, letters that he was receiving that you invoked earlier about saying, well, someone should go out and write some fan fiction about Susan in which she is rehabilitated. And I just want to say that, you know, Gaiman has done that here after a fashion. And this passage that you read is a part of where we get that. But when I say after a fashion here, what I mean is that Gaiman has written a story in which Susan Pevensie grows up to be C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. For one, she is an English professor, so was C.S. Lewis. She has things to say about children literature, so did C.S. Lewis. In fact, we're told that the title of her most recent book is A Quest for Meaning in Children's Fiction, which is more or less the same sort of thing that Lewis gets up to later in his life as well. But also in the passage that you read, Gaiman is giving this character of Professor Hastings, who, right, we think at least is Susan, he's giving this character of Susan many of the biographical details and also just characteristics, I guess, of Lewis, right? That Susan is orphaned. And, well, Lewis wasn't orphaned, but his mother died when he was young and his father was an alcoholic. And there's some parallel there. C.S. Lewis, as a young man in the First World War, had to see bodies like that. This character of Susan sees bodies like that as well. C.S. Lewis becomes a public figure that people are interested in writing newspaper articles about, and that he speaks to the public about social issues, religious issues, and cultural issues, and is really a kind of cultural conservative who doesn't like the changes of the post-war world. And that's, you know, certainly something else that you've brought up here, right? This parenthetical emphasis on the headmaster of the school being a woman and so on is a great example of exactly that. Lewis as the cultural conservative. But here we have Susan not liking the change to the metric system, right? A little bit of cultural conservatism there, right? So Gaiman has very slyly written this story in which the rehabilitation of Susan, something Lewis has invited him to do, is really that Susan grows up to be C.S. Lewis. And I think this is just a brilliant, brilliant story on every level. And that passage, I think, really encapsulates that.
And Professor Hastings here harkens back to the way literature was before it was, as she said, balderized for children to make it sanctimonious and to respect kind of virtue of children. She clearly seems to prefer it back when the Grimm fairy tales were at their kind of true essence in the before time. So if anything, she's kind of looking back as a conservative even further than C.S. Lewis perhaps would.
Yeah, what a masterpiece of a story. Let me just say thank you again to the Patreon supporter who commissioned this episode. We have loved the story. We've loved reading Narnia again. I certainly have loved spending a month just deep in the rabbit hole of Lewis biographies and Lewis scholarship and Lewis criticism. And also, I guess we should thank you preemptively for, although you didn't know you were doing this, though maybe you did, getting us to do an entire bonus series on Mary Poppins at some point. We didn't know that was coming out of this episode, but stand by for that. But at any rate, that is going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Helt. You can find us and our other podcasts at claytemplemedia.com.
Next month, we are going to continue on with some children's literature, but this will be literature for children by Neil Gaiman himself. We're doing a series on the anthropomorphic panda, Chew. We're going to do three episodes, though we will air them all next month. And what that means really is it's one episode for each of the Chew books, which are Chew's Day, Chew's First Day of School, and Chew's Day at the Beach. These are all available in a board book format, also available in a picture book format. And until then, pleasant dreams.